Hello and welcome to Sustainability is Sexy, the podcast where we talk about all things sustainable, from regenerative agriculture, alternative to single-use plastic, and everything in between. I'm your host, Liz Murphy, and each episode I will talk to leaders in the sustainability space to provide insights, innovation, and inspiration for all of us to create a healthier planet. Today, I'm joined by Skylar Knight, a science communicator working for the climate nonprofit Project Drawdown. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm super excited to have you here today. We met at a kind of very unique event where we were both speaking on environmental activism. And I was super excited, being somebody that is aware of Project Drawdown, although I'm very excited to dive deeper into that today because I'm even, you know, have a lot to learn, I think. But knowing the organization and kind of how well known they are, I was just very excited to have a representative at the same event to meet you. And now we're finally getting together and get to dive into things. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And it was great to have you at that event because it was a bit odd. There was lightning throwing, which if you don't know what that is, I would Google it because I had no clue. And it was absolutely fascinating to watch it go down. And yeah, it was great to talk with you, and I appreciated the limited audience where I was giving my talk. You were very enthusiastic about it, which helped give me the confidence to carry forward. So I appreciate it.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. I felt the same when you were talking. We had very similar messages, and that is always encouraging, and you meet like-minded people, in sometimes, the most random of places. So
absolutely.
So we'll talk about many things today, but you know, before we get into Project Drawdown, I would like to learn more about yourself and kind of your background, what obviously brought you to be working there. But let's start off, like, have you always had a passion for environmental activism, or is that something that kind of came on later in life?
For me, it definitely came on later in life. I think a lot of people in the environmental space, although there's a million routes that people take to get into the environmental space, I think for a lot of people, it stems from early childhood connection with nature. And I did not have much of that. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. The most we got outdoors was tailgates for football games. We were very much like a sports family. We didn't do camping. I remember romping around in the woods by our house, which was really outdoorsy, but I never really kind of immerse myself in nature until much later in life. And so I would say it was a pretty slow burn to getting into the environmental space. I studied biology in undergrad, and for me, it was all about going the medical route. It's what my parents told me I was going to do. And so I was really adamant about doing it. But I realized I liked talking about science a lot more than doing it. And it's also around that time that I started finding my love of the natural world and being outdoors more. And so after I graduated and started that pivot, it really just kind of fell one thing into the other. I really loved hiking and being outdoors. I really wanted to find a way to better protect the environment. And I also love talking about science. And so I found a way to marry those two.
Was there a catalyst for that convergence for you? Like, was, you know, because I'm sure there are many scientists and nature lovers that maybe don't put two and two together. So was there anything specific that you saw or heard or, you know, learned that kind of put you on the path towards environmental?
I would say a couple things. One was I went to school in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and I would go hiking up in Muir Woods, and standing around redwood trees is a remarkable experience. Like, if I could get an experience for people around the world to immerse themselves in, it would be just to stand in a grove of redwoods for a little bit, because it's an enlightening experience. And as someone who did not grow up with nature, it was very authentic to feel that kind of place. So I would say that was a big part of it. But then also my partner, she studied conservation and development. She grew up very outdoors here in San Diego, loved the ocean. And she introduced me to a lot of sort of the concepts and foundations in the environmental space that really kind of piqued my interest and got me involved in it. And the last thing I'll add is I did some environmental education with kids. And that is also a great experience if you want to really develop, I think, an appreciation for how closely linked we are to nature. Just watch kids out in the woods picking up rocks and investigating bugs, and no maliciousness, just curiosity and craving that connection. That was also very formative.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's probably something, myself included, that I haven't really had the opportunity to do. I've done some education with kids, but I can imagine that getting outdoors. We also had another individual named Kyle on the podcast that was Sustain SD, who does like gardening and composting work with schools and school-age children. And he just talks about it very similarly in the way that they interact with the plants and the soil, and that level of curiosity and connection that we either never had if you weren't outdoorsy, or lose as we get incorporated into this fast-paced, you know, technological concrete world. So the word sustainability means many different things, and it also means different things to different people. So I'm curious what the word sustainability means to you.
Yeah. Sustainability to me is really a vision. It's a vision for the future that I think most of us want to live in. It's one that's more equitable, where humans and non-human nature are thriving, where we don't look around and kind of think, how did we get ourselves into this mess? But we look around and say, wow, what an incredible world we've created. And we know that it's going to be safe and be there for the next generation and many generations to come. So when I think of sustainability, it's very much a vision. And there's a great scientist, Catherine Hayhoe, who I'm sure has been mentioned on this many times. She's an incredible scientist and also a great science communicator. And I was reading an older article of which she was in, where she's talking a bit about how to communicate climate change to audiences that might be less receptive to it. And in there, when she was talking about sustainability, she really pointed out something that I think is important, which is when we talk about sustainability, I think we're often and intentionally talking about humans. I think nature will rebound. Nature is resilient. Life on the planet will continue. We're talking about making sure that humans can continue to thrive, that we're not in some post-apocalyptic world in a matter of decades, much less centuries, but that we're actually creating something that future generations can thrive in. So we're talking about sustainability of the human race oftentimes. And I think that's right. I think nature is resilient and we'll find a way regardless.
Yes. And that has come up a couple of times on the podcast. Just really talking about, you know, it's the messaging for so many years, rightfully so, has been save the planet. You know, and that message gets straight across what we're trying to accomplish. But at the end of the day, we really are trying to save humanity because the planet will survive. The planet will be here. So it's really us that we're doing this for, in conjunction with, you know, all of the other beings and nature that exist currently. There's a lot of ways to look at environmental activism and a lot of approaches that we can take. We focus a lot on this podcast on individual action, and we'll talk about that, you know, briefly right now, because I think most listeners are very interested in what they can do as individuals, or maybe in their kind of more close-knit family, community, friends, which is always, always important. Another piece, of course, is the larger impactful corporate responsibility type approach that we don't talk about too much on this podcast, but I would like to get into with you as well. So we'll start out with the individual steps. So what do you think are the most important steps that an individual can take when they're looking for ways to be more environmentally friendly?
Yeah, when I think about environmental action on an individual level, I really think usually in two boxes, direct and indirect. So directly, are the things that we can do to reduce our own emissions and our own life? And then indirect, what are the things that we can do as consumers, or what powers do we have just as individuals that can influence the systems of which we are a part in order to get them to reduce their emissions? And I'll talk about that category in a minute, because that's actually, for me, I think indirect action is exciting, and there's a lot of progress to be made there. But the direct things, I think, are things that a lot of people already intuitively know and is totally correct. So things like transportation, things like food, things like what you're doing in your home as far as energy consumption, those are really the three biggest. For most Americans, those are the three biggest, with transport typically being number one for most Americans as far as the emissions that they're individually generating. As far as solutions to those, I mean, transportation can be a tricky one. You know, with any individual action, you have to think about the person as a whole. What are they already doing? What circumstances do they have? What resources are available to them? Because it's not equitable. A lot of solutions aren't going to be available to a lot of people. But with transportation, trying to reduce how much you're driving or going electric, food, I know, is one that you're passionate about. And we could do as much as you want on food, because there's a lot nested within there in order to reduce our associated emissions. And then as far as our homes, you know, there's the obvious ones as far as solar panels and switching out appliances in your house. But honestly, I think a lot of people overestimate how much you have to do around your house in order to reduce emissions. So those are sort of the three big ones.
What impacts as individuals, or the choices that we make, whether it's consumerism, political action, the corporations that we choose to support, like how can we make a difference on this huge, huge problem that can be incredibly overwhelming, and that obviously not one individual is going to change? So what are some of the bigger things?
Yeah, I love that. And when I think of the bigger things, I think a lot in that bucket of indirect actions. And I think consumerism, to your point, that's totally kind of on that cusp. It's very direct, but then it also has indirect effects. Because in addition to reducing your own emissions by buying secondhand, by being more conscientious as a consumer, you're also sending a market signal that those are the products that people want. And that's going to incentivize those companies to continue doing it and incentivize companies that are lagging to kind of pick up the slack. So I love indirect actions, and they touch on those bigger things. And I think, you know, one that's close to home right now, just because we just had a report come out about it, is our banking habits. And so for a lot of people, when you have money in your bank account, which everyone listening, I hope you have copious amounts of it and you have a healthy financial situation. But for all the money in your bank account, it doesn't sit there. The bank uses that. And the reason that they can offer free checking accounts and all these benefits and interest benefits is because when your money's in there, they use it to invest in other things that they can make a return on. So they often invest in big companies, just like you might invest your own 401k or your own portfolio in order to help make that money grow. And I don't think most people think about it, but the bank that you bank with has a diversified portfolio, and that portfolio is going to be more or less carbon intensive depending on the bank. And so we just had a report come out called Saving for the Planet, which is looking at the top 10 most carbon intensive banks in the United States and looking at how much of the money in those individual banks is being invested in carbon intensive sectors like oil and gas expansion, or misuse of food, land use, and agriculture space. And so what they found was that for the worst polluting banks, the banks that have the dirtiest portfolios, you could say, it's up to 30% of all of their investments are going to those industries. And so you have to imagine, if you have, say, $10,000 in that particular bank, up to 30% of your hard-earned money, whether you are intending it to be used that way or not, $3,000 of it or so is being invested into carbon-intensive sectors that might not agree with your values. And so just switching your bank, which I think for a lot of people, especially nowadays with how easy it is online, is a relatively light lift, but can have a huge impact on your indirect carbon emissions. One of the findings that really struck me from the study is, depending on where you bank, so the average across the 10 most carbon-intensive was about like 19 to 20% of their portfolio is being invested in carbon-intensive sectors. But what really made it sink home for me was, I believe for the average American, so for every $1,000 that you have in a carbon-intensive bank, if you were to move that to a climate-responsible bank that doesn't invest in the most carbon-intensive sectors, every $1,000 is about equivalent to the reduced emissions from a cross-country flight, like New York to Seattle cross-country flight every year. And that's per $1,000. So the more money you have, whether you're getting close to retirement and you have a lot more funds, whatever it is, or you're just getting started saving for retirement, the more funds that you can put into a bank, the more money you have, the bigger that impact is going to be in reducing the indirect emissions. And that's on top of sending a market signal to the bank as well, that you don't want to be a part of a bank. So you have power as someone who banks at that particular location. You can make demands of your bank to reduce the carbon intensity of their investments. And if they're not willing to do that, you can take your money elsewhere. And that sends a huge market signal.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that I love about this solution as well is one of the rules of thumb that they found from the study was smaller local banks tend to be better. And that's just great because those are the banks that are also reinvesting that money back into the community. Yes, they're investing in other companies and trying to make a return as a bank, but they're also putting money into the community in a lot of ways. And there's great community credit unions and all sorts of small local banks that are doing great work. And you'd be supporting them on top of reducing your carbon intensity of your money. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, you beat me. You beat me. That was my next question. Oh, was, do you have any thoughts on credit unions, local banking institutions, and why it's super important to consider that when you are either looking to change banks or, you know, looking for a new bank? Because, like, for example, my personal banking currently is separate from my business banking, and I'm trying to kind of get that all in one spot, but it's a process, you know? Just like with everything that we talk about on here, every action that you can take, it does not happen overnight. And just thinking about it is the very first step. And that's more than many people will ever do. So just encouraging people not to get overwhelmed by these things, but just to start your own research, start your own thought process so that when you are ready, you can make those decisions that will have a big impact. So any other banking, what other indirect action items can you recommend?
Yeah, one of my favorite, and you touched on this just now. So that idea of first learning and thinking and doing your research, we kind of have a flow of action that we talk about at Project Drawdown. So that's the first and probably most important step of it. The next is to take action, to make those changes. And the last one, which I think is an important indirect action that I want to bring up, is share your own journey and your experience doing it. And I think that's an indirect action that does not get highlighted enough, is talking about it, talking about climate change, both the threats that it has, but also the opportunities embedded within climate change to make a better world. And also the actions that you're taking as an individual. Talk about it with your friends, talk about it with your family, talk about it on social media. There's a great climate change opinion survey put out by the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications. They're a great subset of Yale University. They do opinion surveys of the US regularly to understand what people think about climate change and climate action. And it's really a dose of optimism because consistently people want to take action on climate change. They care about the issues. They think it should be prioritized by Congress and by the president. It's over 50%, often in the 60 and 70% in favor of climate across the board. But two of the areas that tend to lag a little bit behind are down in like the 30% to 40% favorability, is talking about climate change with at least some frequency and seeing it in the media more than once per week. Those are the two areas consistently. As a communicator, I see that and I'm like, that is a huge opportunity for indirect action. We need to be talking about climate change a lot more and move the needle on that. And that will also have the additional benefit of driving more media coverage to some degree. Media coverage is in part driven by what they think people are going to click on, what people want to read. And if we're talking about climate change more, it's going to feed into all of that. So I think indirect action, talking about climate change, just start doing it. You don't have to be a scientist. You know, you all have lived experiences. You all are seeing what's going on in the world. Just talk about climate like you talk about other issues.
Yeah. Absolutely. I have talked about it on here before, how, you know, at the end of the day, for me, the most successful on a personal level, I mean, obviously in my work life, I'm talking about it all the time. But on a personal level, I find so much success by just living my life and people asking questions and about something very simple that then leads to a conversation where maybe I can tell them a little bit more about what I'm doing, questions they have about what they could be doing. And I've had people that make significant changes because of those simple things. One of the most common ones is when we visit a restaurant, or even more frequently like a pop-up situation, like a farmer's market or something like that. And we always have our own containers and our own utensils to give to the vendors. And we'll be walking around with a, you know, a metal container. And people are like, where did you get that one? And we're like, we brought it from home. And then we get to give it to them. And then our leftovers are in here. And the amount of people that I'm assuming just have never, of course, even considered that as an option sounds so excited. Maybe not even from an environmental standpoint at first, of more of like a, you know, then my leftovers are going to be in my own container and I can just put them in my fridge type situation. But there are so many actions that I'm so used to taking that are slightly outside of the current norm, that I'd like to see become more normalized, that often lead to conversation pieces. So just living your life by example, as you begin to integrate more sustainable practices into your life, you'll find that friends and family and community members are more curious, which opens the door for being more of a champion, you know, and speaking about it more often.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And study after study shows that some of the most trusted people when it comes to talking about climate change is friends and family, which to me is incredible. Like oftentimes above scientists or right in the same ballpark as scientists. So that means for the everyday person, where they get their climate news that actually influences the decisions they make is from friends and family, whether or not they have a science degree or a background in climate science is irrelevant. They trust those people. And so that's exactly right. Like when you're talking to friends and family about the actions you're taking, it has a huge effect, huge ripple effect that I don't think people appreciate.
Yeah. And I would want to put a caveat on that is of in the same thing as not getting discouraged by some obstacles you might find in your own life to making decisions. I'm sure with many decisions, be it climate action or not, we are often met by the people closest to us with rolling eyes and, you know, maybe not the immediate openness that we'd like. And I think that that can be very similar for many people when it comes to climate. You know, I've definitely experienced that myself. And so it's one of those situations that you just navigate personally, you know, like continue to speak about it. Don't cause any issues, but, you know, just always be excited. And that's the biggest thing for me is whether in a professional, like at an event speaking on this, or if I'm talking to friends or family, is like when I'm staying positive and excited, and not being judgmental or argumentative, that is when I find, of course, by far the most success with people. And so that is a big recommendation that I can give is if you can always stay positive, and excited because you're doing it because you're excited about it. And that's going to inspire other people if you can kind of stick to that narrative.
Yes. Yeah. That is a great one. And in science communication and particularly climate communication, that is huge. You know, there's a big conversation around, you know, pessimism or optimism. I think most people are realizing it's kind of in the middle. You know, there's room for both. It's an emotional thing. Climate change is an emotional thing. It is heartbreaking, but it is also joyful. The thriving future that we're working towards is a positive thing. And so approaching it and not shying away from those emotions are huge. And joy is an incredibly powerful emotion and positivity that is going to bring more people on board. So I think that's a huge one for climate communicators in general, and just for people who are trying to get people on board with taking changes or making changes in their own life that are a bit more sustainable.
Yeah, I think realistic optimism.
Yes.
Is kind of what I've landed on in my own personal life when it comes to climate, because I will continue to experience high highs and low lows when it mm-hmm. comes to the climate crisis. But when I find that middle ground of education and understanding of what realistically is happening and excitedly what innovations and steps are being made that continue to inspire me to stay joyful and optimistic. So there's kind of that, yeah, middle ground.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think as far as I'm always thinking as sort of public relations and media, and I think the negative sides of climate change are very effectively communicated, particularly with increasing exposure to disasters and journalists and media becoming much better at calling it climate change when we have attribution science that is able to show us how much it's been exacerbated by climate change. But those joyful moments, I think, sometimes fall under the radar, those people taking action. And that's why a big project that Project Drawdown does is we have a short documentary series called Drawdown's Neighborhood, where we go city by city and we find usually a half dozen to a dozen climate heroes in those locations. And we have them just share their story, how they were impacted by climate change and what they're doing in their own community, both big and small, in order to make a difference. And those stories of hope are among the most effective communication tools that we deploy at Project Drawdown, for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know that I, especially being on social media and the algorithm being on climate for me most often, I am inundated by so much of the realistic information that can be discouraging. And I get very excited when I find the accounts that do the weekly positive climate news and really pull those stories from around the globe of big and small, very exciting information about the climate crisis. And I've started more and more, I think my algorithm is getting that a little bit. I've started to, find those, like them a little bit more so that I can myself have a little bit more of that in my daily life, where I'm seeing those small and large kind of climate positivity and inspirational stories alongside the statistics and the, yes. the scary stuff. So
yeah, we definitely need both.
In this series, we are talking to local sustainable business owners and organizations to highlight tangible resources within our community. Are you a local sustainable business, or do you know someone we should be talking to? Email us at sustainabilityissexythepodcast@gmail.com.
So speaking of Project Drawdown, I'd love to give the listeners, a rundown of who you guys are, what you're doing, and then a little bit about what you are doing with the organization.
Yeah, so Project Drawdown is a climate solutions nonprofit. And really, the idea behind Project Drawdown is the same science that we use to better understand climate change, atmospheric science, how bad things might be or how good they could be if we take appropriate action. We want to apply that same scientific lens to the climate solutions. Which ones are ready to go? Which ones need more work? Which ones are going to be most effective at helping us reach a point where climate change is in the rearview mirror? And so a lot of the work we do is science behind the scenes, looking at solutions and trying to figure out which ones are most appropriate, where we're at with them, how quickly they should be deployed, and what the reductions in emissions will look like if that takes place. And then also communicating that both to policymakers, to the general public, through a variety of channels that we have. In addition to that, we do a lot of storytelling work, like I said, with the Drawdown's Neighborhood program. That's underneath the umbrella of Drawdown Stories, which is specifically about climate storytelling, because stories are what get people to act. The same reason that we trust our friends and family more than almost anybody else is the same reason that stories are so effective. It's because they resonate with something human that is always going to be a degree detached from the numbers or the science. It's about wedding those two is when you get really effective communication. And then we also do work more on the economic side. We have a program called Drawdown Labs, which works with philanthropists, with impact investors, with businesses in order to help them invest in the solutions that are most appropriate and also the ones that are actually going to move the needle on climate change.
And what do you do?
So my job is I do a little bit of everything. So what I love about my job is I'm a communications manager. And so I get to communicate the science. I get to communicate the stories. I get to communicate the economics work that we do. So what I really love about what I get to do is I get to wear many different hats, many different times every single day in order to better understand both the research that our scientists are doing and that our business leaders are doing, but then also communicate that to the public or to policymakers or whatever audience we're trying to reach. So I'd say I'm a bit of a synthesizer. I try to take in the information, synthesize it, and find a good home for it out in the world.
And it sounds like, obviously, there's so many different aspects of the work that the organization is doing, that there's opportunity for involvement from many different levels of whether it's individual companies, philanthropists you mentioned. So if somebody wants to learn more or get more involved on any of those levels, what would your recommendation be?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to get involved as an individual with the work that we do. One that I'll call out that I really love is underneath our Drawdown Labs, which is sort of our economic private sector program at Project Drawdown. We have these guides called Job Function Action Guides, and they're broken down to if you're a marketing professional, if you're in sales, if you're in procurement, if you're a computer engineer or a product manager. There's about 10 in total and more being developed all the time. And they tell you very specifically for your job, how to turn it into a climate job. So how to increase the sustainability of the work that you're doing. And it's really specific. It's you know, done in collaboration with experts in those fields. So it's not a surface level guide. It's very specific for your particular area of expertise. And so those guides are readily available. We encourage you to check those out. So I think that's a huge one that individuals can do. But the other way that you can really support us is sharing our content. We have a great social media manager who manages all of our content on LinkedIn. We're on basically everything except TikTok. They do a great job of sharing our work broadly through those channels. We also have a newsletter written by yours truly. So I would be in your inbox every other week for the foreseeable future. And sharing that content really helps get the word out, both about the climate solutions that we want to deploy, but it also helps share stories of empowerment from Drawdown's neighborhood, ways that your coworkers can get involved through Job Function Action Guide. So sharing our content is actually a huge way that you can support us. And then, of course, all the other ways you can support any 501c3 nonprofit, donations, working in kind, however you can support us.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited about many of those. I think the first part that you mentioned with, you know, where people can find the guides on, you know, their particular industry or position, that's huge. That is huge. Like, what an amazing resource. I'm super excited to share that one. And I'm definitely going to sign up for the newsletter.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Excited about that. We'll be linking all of this in the show notes for people that are looking for it. And I'll mention some stuff at the end as well. So this next question is something I ask every guest that's on the podcast. And I have a feeling that you probably have quite a few answers to the question. So feel free to do multiple, or if you know, doesn't have to be about what you do for a living. It's truly just your personal, your favorite stuff. So do you, Skylar, have a favorite sustainable product or practice that you want to share with our listeners that you use in your own life?
Yeah, my favorite practice is definitely something that I've developed recently, because I did not grow up as much of a cook. I wouldn't say, and you can verify this with my wife. Gosh, I balk at some of the meals that I cooked her in air quotes when we first started dating before I knew how to cook. But honestly, when I became vegetarian, beyond all of the reasons that I did it for environmental reasons or animal rights reasons or whatever it is, the sheer diversity of skills that I learned, the new flavors, the new recipes, I had to get so much more creative in the kitchen. And now cooking is one of my favorite things. So I would say if you're a chef or you consider yourself the cook in your family, and whether or not you're vegetarian, even if meat is sort of a primary thing that you cook, I encourage you to look at vegetarian or vegan recipes because it's incredible. It's opened up a whole new world of flavors and ways to cook things. And I have my favorite cookbooks that I can also plug. I don't know if that's fine.
Of course.
I don't know if you have a cookbook.
I do.
Okay. Well, I'll plug yours first and foremost, which I have not read.
Yeah. I did want to just like interject here and say that this was not planned.
Yes.
This is not a personal plug for what I do for a living. And I'm very, very excited that this is your recommendation. So.
Yeah. So your cookbook, of course, which I look forward to cooking all the recipes from, but ones that have really opened my eyes to how incredible vegetarian and vegan cooking can be. Anything by Yotamoto Langi. He's great. He has a mix of things from, I don't know how to cook. And there's some very basic ones that are great for that, all the way through to, I really have some time to invest and want to get creative and bust out the mortar and pestle. He has everything in between. There's an incredible cookbook called Yeast by Mira Soda. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but she does recipes all across sort of Southeast Asia, Japanese, Thai, Indian, everything, sort of Eastern-based cooking. And I have not made a single recipe from that has not been delicious. And then as someone who grew up in Kentucky, soul food, you know, I grew up ribs, burgers, those were sort of the staples. And there's a book called Vegetable Kingdom by Bryant Terry, which is incredible. Soul food, as well as soul food from all cultures, Caribbean soul food, West African soul food. And his cookbook is just a masterpiece. So I would plug those in addition to Liz's cookbook, of course.
Thank you. Which for those that don't know, it's called Kitchen Contentment. And it's through my company, Santosha Nutrition. But I am so appreciative of you bringing that up, because I think many people who either don't cook or kind of are daunted by cooking, especially if they are not vegan or vegetarian or have not been around that type of cuisine very often, just don't even really consider it as an option. It's not something that you really think about. But these days, you know, cookbooks aside, I mean, the internet is just, you know, full, of course, of recipes, techniques, inspiration, veganizing your favorite foods, you know, all those ones that you mentioned, you know, you can veganize all of those. And it's something that is so fun to try. I always tell people, you know, because even if I'm speaking to other chefs maybe, and they scoff at the idea of being a plant-based chef, and all I can say is there are so many more plants in this world to play yes. with than there are animal products. And I find that to be a huge inspiration with the flavors, colors, textures, cultures associated with the immense amount of edible plant life that we have on this planet. And so I love that you brought that up, and I second it wholeheartedly.
Yeah. And I really love seeing vegetarian and vegan food get more into the high dining space as well. There's a cookbook, I forget, the first name's Tal, I forget the last name. It's called Crossroads, and it's based on a restaurant that opened in LA. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been to the restaurant. I really want to check it out, but I got the cookbook, and it's remarkable. I mean, you go through, and these dishes are just insane. And to your point about like the diversity of plants and the things that you can do with them, it's absolutely incredible. So if you're a foodie, or someone who considers yourself a chef and you predominantly eat or cook meat-based food, you don't have to go full vegetarian or vegan, but I encourage you to start dipping your toe into that space, because it's an incredible world of flavor and creativity. It's really fun.
I agree. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I think the other thing I would say to your point about buying secondhand, so I agree. First thing you should do, especially with clothes, there's incredible resources now for buying nice secondhand clothes online, or go to your local thrift store or whatever it might be. For those times when you really need something new, you can't find something, or maybe it's workout clothes, which is always a bit on the fence with secondhand, and you do need something new, there's a great website that my brother-in-law showed me called Good On You, and they evaluate I haven't come across a clothes brand that's not on there really, and they evaluate how good they are to workers, how good they are to the planet, and how good they are to, I believe it's animals, whether they do sort of any animal product testing or anything like that. And they give them a grade, and then they talk about, are they transparent, and what do they do well, and what do they need to improve on? So I encourage you, for those times when you can't find something secondhand or you need to purchase something new, that website has honestly been a great resource for me to help assuage some of that guilt when you do need something new.
Yeah, I use that website myself, and I've been lucky, you know, in the past few years to have really, especially as a part of Sustainability Sexy, met so many people in the local San Diego community that provide resources on whether it's upcycled or secondhand or thrift or all of these amazing opportunities. But yeah, there are certain items that are a little more difficult, or maybe just you don't want secondhand. So it's really great to have resources like Good On You, where you can know that you're making the best and most informed decision that you can as a consumer. So thank you so much for joining me today, Skylar. You can find more information about Project Drawdown online at drawdown.org. And I just want to give a huge shout out to you for being here, because you, like I mentioned, you inspired me so much in our first meeting. And it just means a lot to be able to have this conversation with you. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for all the good work you do.
As always, all of the resources and brands mentioned in today's podcast will be linked for your reference. And until next time, I'm Liz Murphy, sending you sustainability love from San Diego.
Sustainability is Sexy is a nonprofit organization located in San Diego, California, focused on inspiring and driving innovation within our community to create real change. Learn more at sustainabilityissexy.org and find out how you can be involved.